ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. Welcome once more to The Minefield. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. How you doing?
I'm well.
Yeah, actually. You sound like you're kind of just holding up. You all right?
Yeah. Okay. I'll be all right.
All right.
I'll punch through. There'll be some drug or other that'll help me out. Yes. Well, that was very deliberate by me. I feel like that's who we are now as people, isn't it? If every problem, there should be a pill that fixes it. Do you agree?
Yes. And before I say anything bad about it, let me just confess, as someone who basically does not like, I mean, I do all the food preparation in the family, so I kind of live with food, but I fundamentally dislike eating. And so if there were, in fact, a pill that I could take two or three times a day that would give me everything that I needed and let me go on my way and spend time doing other things, I would gladly, gladly take it.
That's extraordinary. You are the only person I know who matches that description.
I dare say, Willie, there may be any number of things that we could say, and the appropriate response would be, you are the only person that I know.
I think that's probably right. Hey, as for today's show, in a way, it's bizarre we haven't spoken about this before. Mm. In fact, I'm not even sure we've gestured towards this topic.
I think we've touched on some cognate issues. Okay. There's certainly things that we'll be gesturing back towards, but yes, this is brand new territory for The Minefield. I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, which is strange because it's been in our consciousness for what, 2 years? Maybe a bit longer.
Yep.
We are talking here about the rise of, well, I was going to say they're weight loss drugs, but actually they're not. They're originally conceived for different things. They just seem to be very useful for dealing with especially obesity. So the most famous of these, of course, is Ozempic, but there are so many others. It's one of those things where the name of that drug has kind of stood in for a whole class of drugs. And even I think that one might have been superseded by several, but we still use that one. It's become kind of a generic name. I don't know. I feel like there are about a million different ways we can take this conversation because it's interesting in so many different ways. But I'm going to let you have the floor because I know you have a vision for this show.
Oh, my goodness. Look, vision may well not be the right way of describing it. There are things about the cultural moment in which the GLP-1 based weight loss drugs. And, you know, let's just call them by their names. We're talking really about Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, Zepbound. These are the primary ones. They all fundamentally, I mean, you're right, they have their origins as forms of treatment for type 2 diabetes. There were further applications that have been discovered. I should also just say there are new applications that are being discovered all the time. Some really interesting research is being done on the way that some of these drugs might actually help with other forms of addictive behavior. It could be that it's part of a treatment regimen for those who are suffering from, say, alcoholism or other forms of addiction. So it's interesting to see in real time how further applications for what was a relatively limited or targeted drug, what further applications they might have. But it was really interesting to me back in 2023 to watch, you're right, Ozempic has kind of become the stand-in term for this entire class of weight loss drugs. It's become almost a kind of, I mean, there can be references in pop culture that are both immediately recognizable and instantly hilarious. Let me just make reference to one episode. My next to youngest son is going back and watching, yes, the complete South Park back catalog.
That's a big undertaking.
It's a big undertaking. He's just coming to the end of grade 12, so what else is he going to do? He watched an episode the other day called The End of Obesity, during which the young, portly Cartman, who's kind of, you know, immediately, again, sort of iconically recognizable, he hears about Ozempic. He tries to get a prescription. He finds out that his mother can't afford it. He finds out through her that their insurance doesn't cover it. And in place of being prescribed Ozempic to help with his own portliness, a counselor recommends to him, instead of this, how about you try listening to more Lizzo? And Cartman's response is, rich people get Ozempic, poor people get body positivity, which is an instantly hilarious line.
Yeah.
But it also says something, I think. It gestures in the direction of a kind of cultural divide that is emerging. So look, there are all sorts of ethical issues surrounding the use of Ozempic-like weight loss drugs. There are any number of directions we could take this. I'll just gesture in the direction, for instance, that I think any serious ethical political conversation about the availability and the widespread prescription of Ozempic to people who are not suffering from type 2 diabetes should really begin with the assurance that supply for, say, the discretionary use of the drug should never take away from the necessary or the life-saving use of that drug. In other words, this should not bring about a condition of scarcity of supply such that those who really need it don't have access to it.
Well, which is exactly what it did.
Which is exactly what it did. That's right. Yeah. So I think, I mean, to my mind, that's kind of like an ethical baseline. So if we can just sort of put that there on the shelf and leave it as read. Outside of that, I've got to say that many of the other critiques that have been mounted about the use of Ozempic, they just don't interest me all that much. For instance, people who say that it's cheating. How is using something that decreases your appetite, that helps you control your hunger levels, and that therefore decreases the amount of food that you eat, how is that really different from, say, bariatric surgery? From the use of something like it's less invasive in many respects. It could be less dangerous. I don't see that as really a convincing or an overly significant point of critique.
But I also think it's bariatric surgery is for the obese. I think when people are talking about Ozempic, they're talking about it as cheating. They're not dealing with, or they don't have in mind people who are using it effectively as a treatment for obesity. I think what they have in mind is, I don't know, the Hollywood starlet or the influencer or whatever who doesn't have an obesity problem but simply wants to look, I don't know, 15% hotter.
Sure.
And so it comes back to that discretionary sort of use.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I see your point, but I think there might be an apples and oranges thing there.
Absolutely right. I don't dispute it. Here's my issue, though. There is and there has long been a kind of obsession with weight loss. There has been, in not just Western cultures, but in certain affluent cultures, a kind of preoccupation not just with health, but with the appearance of health. In other words, there's a kind of aesthetic that goes along with the preoccupation with weight loss. And that is the elevation of certain body characteristics to the level of not just, I was about to say sort of aesthetic perfection, but really sort of aesthetic desirability. So things like, for instance, the way that we privilege thinness, the way that we privilege now aesthetically, physically, firmness or cutness, the way that we privilege with respect to the skin, smoothness, the way, for instance, that various forms of sort of hair sculpting, hair removal, the rendering of the skin almost plastic in its perfection. If there are desirable marks on the body, they aren't the marks that are given from birth, but the ones that are chosen. In other words, the use of ink, of tattooing. The body itself, the appearance of the body, becomes a canvas upon which one asserts its own will. I become, if you like, the agent of my own appearance. So there's something kind of remarkable about that cultural aesthetic that has grown up. In many respects, this was very, very well diagnosed by a very odd and since kind of disreputable French theorist named Hervé Jouvin, who talked about the emergence of the body as retrieving itself from a state of nature and instead giving itself to its own manufacture. The things that typify or that qualify beauty are those things that we then control about ourselves. This really kind of came home for me powerfully when I was opening an exhibit at the Institute for Modern Art here in Brisbane. It was an exhibit devoted to the work of the artist, the Kunsthalle artist, Thomas Hirschhorn. And there was one video display called Touching Reality. And it was right back at the beginning of kind of, you know, of touch screens. And it was a video of a perfectly manicured hand zooming in on grainy images of immense physical ugliness and immense physical destruction. So body parts lying on a street, one would assume in Iraq or Afghanistan. The physical features of a man or a woman with uncontrolled body hair, almost bestial in their hairiness, or pockmarked or scarred, terrible teeth. You would almost want to say that all of the images were of humans living almost in a state of nature, subservient to nature, and not in control of themselves, their appearances, their fragrances. And yet, all the while, you have this incurious or slightly removed, perfectly manicured hand zooming in, scrolling out, and swiping, as though the hand were focusing in on a catalog or a copy of Vanity Fair. And it seemed to me in many respects to be kind of the perfect way of capturing the fact that because of the way that we privilege certain forms of appearance, the way that thinness, firmness, smoothness, cutness, not even the reality of being healthy, but the appearance of this kind of health or this kind of beauty, it's almost as if humanity itself has been divided down the middle. It's almost as if there are those who are in control of how it is they look, how it is their skin appears, what they smell like, how much hair they have, what their body appears to be. And then there are those who are simply still living in the state of nature. Now, this is a way of almost radicalizing the association that has long existed between laziness, indolence, obesity, ugliness, and class. Those have so often kind of bound together in this horrible, hellish little bundle. Whereas those who are able to remove themselves from all those social and economic determinants, they then have the control over their bodies. They can be the masters, the agents of their own appearance. You know, weight loss drugs like Ozempic are dropping into this kind of environment where thinness, smoothness, beauty isn't just the way things are or an attribute for some people, but rather these things have been moralized. If you are thin, it is because you have subjected yourself to a certain regimen that's required. Sacrifice, self-control, early mornings, hard runs, steady weights, time with a personal trainer, and so on. In other words, beauty is a moral achievement. Whereas ugliness, obesity, the lack of self-care, indolence, incontinence, the lack of self-control, these are likewise a kind of moral failure. When a drug like this that divorces a certain appearance of thinness, of firmness, of health, divorces it from the moral conditions that we've come to associate that thinness, that firmness with. In other words, they're thin not because of a certain degree of strenuousness or a certain degree of self-sacrifice, but rather because of their capacity, their ability to afford access to this drug. Now, look, I'm aware that in the U.S. there may well be moves underway as we speak to subsidize the cost of some GLP-1 drugs. But when a drug like this drops into that kind of environment where people continue to accrue the moral and social benefits that have in the past been associated with thinness, smoothness, firmness, and everything else, then you end up with a kind of really grotesque deepening of this deeper divide between human beings that could run down along the lines of class, but that also end up becoming aesthetically really, really problematic. So one of the things that, for instance, has really troubled me over the last few months has been reading testimonies of people who have gone on a course of Ozempic or Wegovy, for instance, for 6-8 months, and have found people around them in their workplace, friends, acquaintances, treating them fundamentally different. Career opportunities, romantic opportunities, social opportunities opening up that weren't there before as the result of their them availing themselves to these particular types of weight loss drugs. If we want to demoralize body appearance, that would be an extraordinary thing. If we want to take the values that we have come to associate socially, ethically, with certain forms of not just body image, but also, again, the list, smoothness, thinness, everything else, that would be an extraordinary thing. My concern is that the widespread availability of weight loss drugs like Ozempic might not be challenging those presumptions, might not be challenging that association, the moralization of a particular body image with fitness. My concern is that what it may well be doing is deepening that same association, but now those that actually have the benefits accrue to them aren't those who have actually engaged in forms of discipline or health consciousness or self-sacrifice, but rather have simply been able to afford it.
Yeah, but doesn't that mean that it is demoralized?
But not when the social benefits continue to accrue, as if no, something's been
accomplished. That's my point. The fact that the social benefits continue to accrue, even if people know that this result has been achieved through Ozempic, or you don't even have to go to Ozempic, through cosmetic surgery.
Sure.
Which, by the way, interestingly, is becoming far more openly discussed and declared, right? It used to be, when I say used to be, probably as recently as 5-10 years ago, people would deny having had work done, right? There is this phenomenon, I understand, or I'm told from people who should know, on social media, of well-known people, so, you know, famous figures, starting to talk through the various cosmetic procedures they've had. In other words, they're not hiding it any longer. They're saying, yeah, this is what I did, and my surgeon's great, and blah, 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 right? The curtain is being pulled back here, whether it's via Ozempic or it's via some other cosmetic procedure. This has not been naturally obtained. You know, I have reshaped my nose, or I've reshaped my cheekbones, or I've taken this drug that radically suppresses my appetite and the weight has fallen off, etc. That suggests a lack of preoccupation with notions of cheating. It suggests that what is desirable here isn't really mastery of the self over nature, you know, a kind of sovereignty of how my body will appear irrespective of what nature has to say about it, the expression of discipline, etc. I mean, in some ways, I would say, at the very least, that would be connected to something that is a kind of virtue. We do talk about things like discipline, restraint, and so on in a virtuous register.
Yes, that's true.
Leaving aside anything to do with aesthetics, these are virtuous concepts, right? So that if you want to say that's moralizing aesthetics, okay, yeah, maybe, but actually, this is a well-established, long-term moral language that we're talking there. I would say, actually, what this is suggesting is the opposite. The aesthetic is the thing that matters. How you got there is increasingly beside the point. Now, maybe what I hear you saying is, sure, but these aesthetic conventions have gathered around a set of ideas to do with self-control and so on. Yeah, maybe that's true. And we would not be making any particularly new observation in saying that aesthetic judgments do often reflect some kind of social setting and some kind of set of social imperatives. You know, it's not so long ago that what was attractive was actually size, mm-hmm. right? So if you were, I mean, what we would probably now call overweight was considered attractive. Why? Because it was a marker of success. It was a marker of being able to have control over or access to resources and so on.
And the capacity to engage in leisure, for instance, or access to better food.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And we're actually at a very strange time in our history where obesity is for the poor and health, or at least the appearance of health, seems to be for the wealthy. It used to be inverted.
Yes.
Right? So that is an unusual thing.
But that also still does have something to do with the lack of steady availability of, say, healthy food.
Food deserts, is that what they call them?
Yes, exactly.
Particularly
right.
In a place like the United States and our increasing reliance on processed food.
But also certain forms of labor that don't allow for sufficient leisure to indulge in forms of fitness or self-care. So, I mean, there are all sorts of kind of class markers that go all the way down. But I do
So I would be with you if what you were saying is the arrival of these weight loss drugs is reinforcing the class dimensions of this. Sure. But I don't think I'm with you if you want to say that what it's actually doing is reinforcing the moral judgment at the heart of this. because of things like self-control. I think if that were
it's
true...
I don't think it's reinforcing the moral judgment. What it's doing is it's parasitizing, or it's capitalizing on the fact that that moralization of a certain body shape already exists. And what we're now having is one class of people that either through their wealth and or through their access to pharmaceutical weight loss interventions are able to exempt themselves from a kind of state of nature to which others are all too often subject.
Right, but doesn't that fundamentally change the calculus? If it's achievable via non-virtuous means, let's call it that, for the purpose of the discussion, then it breaks the link, doesn't it?
It may well, but that's not where we are right now.
Isn't it?
No.
Why not? As these things become more and more declared...
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I'm not saying is all to the good, by the way.
They're not sort of simply being declared. I mean, there is still the phenomenon of Ozempic shaming, for instance, people who are then pinpointed and outed on social media or in news reports or whatever as achieving the condition that they're in as a result of resorting to Ozempic as if they've, you know, done something underhanded or otherwise untoward.
Yeah, I can sort of understand that. But I wouldn't say it's on a par with denial of steroid use, for example.
Sure.
Right? Where you have, like, again, I understand from people who would know better than I do, these influencers on social media who are achieving all sorts of body transformations and they're doing it with the use of steroids, but they will never declare that and they would deny that in order to provide a false image.
Yeah, claiming caveman diets, for instance. Or
Yeah, whatever it is. I don't think, you know, Ozempic is on par with anything like that. And actually, in some ways, what you're talking about where, you know, on the male side of this spectrum, where you're talking about, I think you kept saying things like firmness and cutness and so on. In some ways, that is not about being subject, also overcoming being subject to nature. In some ways, that's returning more to a pre-modern lifestyle where the achievement of that kind of physicality would have been occasioned by the way in which you lived.
That's right. The important point, though, is agency rather than being subject.
Okay. So agency and reliance on a drug is a form of agency, I suppose, in that you make the choice to receive it and or to go and access it if you have the means. But it's a different, I just think it's a different form of agency. So what are we trying to identify here? Are we trying to identify that there are all kinds of assumptions or value systems or moralizations that have gone into forming our aesthetic judgments? Well, yes, okay, I'd be prepared to say that. But the idea that that moral equivalence remains, even as those aesthetic forms are achieved through less morally loaded means, I think suggests that there's something more going on than merely the importation of certain moral ideals or certain moral judgments or condemnations of those who don't attain these aesthetic goals. It could just be that via whatever series of factors, we've landed on a set of, like a consensus of what is beautiful. And it's now reached a point where we don't much care how it's achieved. We still regard that as beautiful.
That might be part of it. But I think what it's missing is the thorn on the stem, the sting in the tail, which is that when you can look like this, there then becomes an obligation to look like this, a demand, as Heather Widows, a wonderful moral philosopher, puts it, a demand to be beautiful, which means that when you relinquish it, when you fail to take that up.
Isn't that a human nature?
When I say no, because we are talking about a very specific ideal of this is what it means to be beautiful, to be available.
But the ideal you've spoken about is also quite broad, right? You were talking about smells and so on. Well, that's always been part of what we would regard as proper comportment in the world, right?
Sure. But when there's an ideal and then there's a demand, then there's also approbation and there is censure when that demand isn't reached. And that's the problem when I think people who are given opportunities, who are given recognition, who are given a degree of social standing, or even simply are being treated as more fully human as the result of enjoying a particular course of weight loss drugs. That's the thing that tells me that it's not, I mean, part of this is about parasitizing on a previous kind of moralization of a particular body image. But the other part of it is once you can, then there becomes an obligation that everyone must or everyone should look like this.
I just wonder why you couldn't see this as just the animalistic part of human beings.
No, I think that there's something else going on.
Why though?
Why don't we talk about it with our guest?
Fair enough. I see what you did there.
Yeah, listen, you might have been a meta national, you guys.
That's a callback for those been paying attention. Will
did
it
you
always
just do
my name?
Cartman? Are you kidding me?
Why, you didn't like that?
Oh, I loved it, but I only recognized it halfway through.
Yeah, well, that is the issue because him resetting the minefield on Radio National is not a common. If I'd said something like, skiing ass, anger him, that would be a different thing. Anyway, Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Eric Cartman is our guest. But we have another guest who is about to join us, Scott.
We've just seriously reached the point of no return in the show. Good heavens. Our guest, thank goodness for our guest, Fiona Willer, is a lecturer in nutrition and dietetics at the Queensland University of Technology. She's also the president of Dietitians Australia, which kind of makes you the perfect guest to have on The Minefield. Thanks so much for joining us, Fiona.
I'm just finishing up my giggle. Thank you for having me. It's been so interesting listening to the discussion so far. So I'm going to jump right in.
Please, just go.
Because I think it's been a really wide-ranging discussion. And my perspective here is of someone who deeply understands the relationship between the way that people eat and then what that might look like on a body. And also the reasoning behind people's choices to do this kind of thing. And we've had a discussion around body as canvas as a form of visual expression. And certainly there's a component of the population who likes to do that in all sorts of different ways. But in my experience, that is not the regular human being who might be thinking about accessing a GLP-1 drug or, in fact, any kind of weight loss method. We're really here around how body size has got social currency. And I see GLP-1s, I do see them deeply problematic because it's yet another way for people to starve themselves. And that is, there's no question that's what happens when people take them. That is their method of effectiveness. It sits at the end, it's just the current version of a long line of other methods, smoking, drug use, frank starvation, all sorts of weird and wonderful fad diets, all of those things which actually undermine health but might give people the appearance on the surface of being healthy. And that connection between what we eat, we can't read bodies like tea leaves to figure out what they've eaten. It's actually quite an involved process to understand eating patterns and nutrition status and health across a lifespan. You know, the achievement of a particular type of appearance, if it is by intentional means, is always a temporary proposition. Might make the pinnacle of, you know, the Everest of body standards for about a breath in their whole lifespan. The issue I see is that we have a health system that echoes or mirrors these kinds of the social currency around body size. And so we see a lot of discrimination in terms of body size for access to healthcare that's very normal and relatively easy to access for smaller bodied people. So that's really the issue here. We're talking about ethics. We can't talk about the ethics of body size without talking about the kind of access and ethics of the healthcare system as well.
Sorry, Fiona, can you be more specific on that?
Sure. So, I mean, in Australia, we have what we like to call a universal health system, but we know you just scratch the surface and when it's not geographically universal, it's not universal in terms of being able to be financially accessible to people everywhere. And as soon as your BMI goes over 25, which is the top of what's considered the healthy weight range, and now that doesn't mean you're healthy, it just means it's a kind of lower risk category. Actually, even now, the overweight category is the lowest health risk category. But, you know, people don't like to relabel categories here with body size. But as soon as your BMI is over 25, you start to experience difficulties accessing normal things like IVF, like knee replacements, transplants. That's just the health system. Also, the larger you get, the harder it is to emigrate, the harder it is to access adoption. There's a whole heap of ways in Australia where weight discrimination is unchecked. And all of that is an expression of this, these prejudicial beliefs around the purity of a certain body size, the way somebody might live who has that body size, and it's all smoke and mirrors. It's nonsense. We need to unpack it and start getting people thinking differently about body size and health and humanity.
So just to be clear, is your assertion that none of these discriminatory practices is based on anything. So that, for example, the denial of, I think you mentioned access to, what was it, knee replacements or something like that?
Yeah, people love to talk about knees.
Yeah, I mean, it hadn't occurred to me until you mentioned it, but that there is no scientific basis for saying, well, yeah, but in order for this to work and in order for this to be an effective operation, you can't carry this much weight because it will put too much stress on whatever, or it will mean that we're back here again very quickly or whatever. You're saying that in none of these cases, is there a sound scientific basis for this differential treatment?
Well, we do know that larger bodied people with knee replacements look after them better than smaller bodied people, actually. So they fail less when we look at the data. Mm. But it's in a system where we've got the entities that design and make these appliances, the actual knee replacement that goes in there, that make a certain, I mean, there's innovations in there, but the fact that there is less appetite for innovating to make an appliance that suits the human spectrum of body size, when we can build skyscrapers on cantilevers, surely we can build a knee that can cope with an amount of weight above it. And also in terms of training of health professionals and, you know, we can operate on neonates in the womb. And people are seen as heroes who do that. And yet there is this lack of motivation for innovation at getting really great healthcare to larger body people, particularly if it's on the context of, no, that person doesn't have to starve to access my service. It's a huge ethical and moral issue that people shouldn't have to grapple with just existing in a larger body.
So in so many ways, what you just described maps, I think, on one of the fundamental shifts that took place in the mid-1970s, towards the end of the 1970s. After the Second World War, there was the sense that poverty, destitution, homelessness, even bankruptcy, is a condition that could pretty much overtake anybody. Therefore, we put into place certain social mechanisms to ensure that if misfortune overtakes us, there is a way for us to bear one another up. Because there was the disassociation of various forms of impoverishment, of homelessness, and all these things with personal or moral failure.
Oh yeah, weight loss, the whole sector is a bootstrap operation.
Okay. So one of the reasons that there is a overtly discriminatory or even overtly punitive approach to those who are classified as being overweight, obese, is because we continue to associate their appearance, their size, with a degree of failure.
Around this unsubstantiated belief that if somebody eats a certain way, that their body will look a certain way. Now, when we look at the actual eating habits of people across the weight spectrum, and if you categorise them by these BMI categories, normal weight, overweight, obese, and you only look at the dietary quality and you only look at the kilojoule or energy components in there, it's very difficult to differentiate one from another. So larger body people do not eat a whole heap more than smaller body people. There's a lot of overlap as well. So you might have a smaller body person who's eating more than a quite larger body person because that is the way their metabolism goes versus the way the larger body person's metabolism goes. In terms of dietary quality, they eat ostensibly the same way. And because we've got these social beliefs about food, what, in my observation, I think is going on subconsciously is that people, smaller body people particularly, and if they've got a degree of social power, perhaps they're in the health sector or policy, that if they eat a certain, like nobody eats to the dietary guidelines, very few people do. And in fact, it is kind of a running joke within nutrition and dietetic circles that anyone who does eat the dietary guidelines needs to have an assessment done for an eating disorder. Like it is so unusual, right? On paper, it's about 7% of the population. Very, you know, there will be a proportion of people in there who are living their best lives, but there's a lot of control and planning that has to go into eating that way. Everyone else eats all sorts of different things, and in today's food environment, that includes processed foods and all sorts of other bits and pieces. Now, for a smaller bodied person, and particularly someone who, let's take a doctor or a specialist, eats a certain way and thinks, goodness, if I eat like this, that larger bodied person must eat infinitely, quote unquote, worse than I do. And so there's all of these assumptions. And it happens in reverse as well. So larger bodied people often will say, like, oh, I'm trying so hard, I'm eating really well, I'm following this. It's so, why isn't anything changing? I must still be eating, quote unquote, terribly compared with random thin person I see on the street, because there isn't this understanding of the complexity of intake and how really it's a bit of you get what you get and you don't get upset in terms of metabolisms from a genetic standpoint. So we've got all of this misunderstanding, and there's also these other beliefs. People believe that if you eat a certain, you start eating quote unquote a healthy diet, that your body will naturally drift towards a quote unquote healthy looking body size. That belief system sits as a fully developed belief system in people's heads at the same time as the knowledge that to lose a significant amount of weight requires severe energy restriction, including taking a weight loss drug or having bariatric surgery. So those two belief systems can't exist at once together, yet they do seem to exist as separate systems in people's brains. They will use one operating system when they want to have some sort of self-preserving position on one issue, and they'll access the other belief system again when they want to have a self-preserving position on another issue. It's a convenience belief system. Even in nutrition professionals, yeah, these belief systems coexist. It drives me insane.
I guess my deeper question is, and I should probably just take a quick step back. Our family has been touched on two different occasions for two prolonged periods of time with eating disorders. And to be grappling with that and the constant state of emergency on the one hand, and to find oneself swimming through what I think can at very best or generously be described as a food-obsessed environment,
mm-hmm,
whether these be sort of ads for the unhealthiest or constant, you referred to bootstrapping mechanisms, bootstrapping shows. I mean, one of the worst of the bouts took place during the height of The Biggest Loser, which was, that's a whole conversation for another day.
Yeah.
But the idea of the inescapability of food, either you're preoccupied by what you shouldn't eat, or you're preoccupied by what's sometimes referred to as food noise. Just, it's always there in the background, always there in the background.
Yeah.
So you have an environment that
primed.
That is primed, exactly right. That for me is kind of, those are the background conditions. What is it that explains, you've just described a condition of almost permanent cognitive dissonance.
Absolutely, that's what it is.
Okay, but what is it that produces that? Because it seems to me that there is either a value system, a system of moralization, I described it before as a demand to be a particular way, and if you aren't a particular way, then you have fundamentally failed. What is it that creates that separation, that living in a state of contradiction, even among people who should or in fact do know better?
Well, look, we've got to think about how we have a whole lifetime of conditioning around food and what food means to us as social creatures. And then our appearance does tend to signal things to people, and we have a social currency around appearance. So you were mentioning before, doors do open more easily in a less creaky manner for smaller body people than large body people in multiple domains. And so seeing that social currency, hearing, I mean, it is intergenerational. You know, you've got all of this fear around weight gain, all of this obsession around weight loss, as if it is, again, like we're made of clay and we can just mold ourselves with enough effort into a different body size. The fuel to this is this idea of modifiability of body size. And the answer is yes, you can, but very temporarily. And some bodies will not do that either. While that idea around modifiability persists, we will have these systems that prejudice and perpetuate the doors not opening as readily for some than others.
Hmm. This is The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. I'm Scott Stevens. My co-host, as always, is Waleed Ali. And we're joined this week by Fiona Willer. She's lecturer in nutrition and dietetics at the Queensland University of Technology. And look, I should mention that if you or someone you know needs support with body image or an eating disorder, help is available. You can contact the Butterfly Foundation on 1-800-ED-HOPE. That's 1-800-333-4673. All right, Waleed, I'm just going to let you jump in here.
Fiona, I wonder if part of the problem in the way we're discussing this is, even in the very basic understanding, that almost instinctive understanding that people have about the nature of weight loss, about healthy looking bodies and so on, is that we're only talking about the intake aspect of it. We haven't even spoken about the exercise aspect of it, the use of energy, sedentary lifestyles, all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
And we can't ignore that. That has to be part of that conversation. Because I think what is churning in the background when people see someone who looks, who's in a body that they regard as looking unhealthy, is not just that they might be eating badly. It's also that they're not, that they're being lazy in some way. They're not. Now, I'm sure there are many, many cases in which that is not true and so on. So you don't have to convince me of that. But if we're talking about cognitive dissonance here, I wonder if actually we might be slightly overstating it, because people do experience these things in their lives. They have experienced times where they are being far more disciplined with their exercise, for example, and they do notice a transformation. Okay, they might not transform into the idealized form, but they do transform in some kind of way.
Yeah.
And if the exercise regime is sustainable and not overly extreme, and the nutrition program isn't overly extreme either, then it can actually be sustainable. I'm aware that there are very depressing stats on weight loss and how much, how often or infrequently that is maintained after 5 years or whatever. And very often that is the basis of things like surgical intervention in the case of people who are obese or whatever. So I'm aware of that. But I do think that something else is going on here, where it's not that people are holding totally contradictory ideas in their heads so much as they're also drawing on experiences in their own lives that they have literally seen, or in the lives of people they know that they've literally seen. And it doesn't have to be that people are starving themselves. It doesn't have to be that people are behaving in totally unsustainable ways in order for those changes to be observable. And once that's the case, then the cognitive dissonance, well, I don't know if it totally dissolves, but it's certainly ameliorated to some degree, isn't it?
Well, we have an issue with, again, the conflation of fitness and fatness. So fitness is fantastic. You do feel great when you have been following a regimen of strength, activities, cardio, all the rest. You're much more fit for purpose in your life when you're regularly physically active. And we encourage that through the lifespan. So as you age, you're much less likely, if you do fall, to have a fall that's so cataclysmic that you end up breaking a hip. And that's kind of, you know, it tends to be the death knell over time. So we do want people strong and fit, but that's quite separate from their level of fatness. And we tend to, people conflate that fitness and fatness to the point where, oh, you know, I really feel I've got to lose some weight. I just feel slow, so sluggish. I'm like, could it be possible that you're just unfit right now? Perhaps doing some more physical activity and some strength-based and getting some focus on what you can actually do. Because the thing is that weight is not a behaviour, but physical activity is a behaviour. You can do physical activity in a way that you can't do numbers on a scale, because that is a much more distanced outpoint that's got multiple determinants in it.
True, but all I'm saying is I think people have also experienced in their lives that they're not wholly divorced phenomena either.
No, but the weight difference, if you take somebody whose normal body habitus is a larger body habitus,
yeah,
and they're like, right, I'm going to get super fit, okay, good, go and do that. The weight change will be modest, but the fitness improvement will be reflective of the kind of physical activity that they're doing and the frequency.
Yeah.
And
so they're not necessarily in proportion is what you're saying.
Correct. But if people go on a fitness tilt with the purpose of weight loss, they will end up, well, they do end up thinking, well, what is the point of this? I haven't lost the kind of weight that I thought I would by joining the running club or whatever it is that they've decided to do. But they're hugely fitter, and this is a great outcome. But if they're doing that all for the purpose of body size change, it means that it's an external motivator rather than an intrinsic motivator, and people are much more easily discarding of those when they haven't got the outcome they thought that was happening.
Okay, so that's really interesting. This brings us to one of the aspects of the objections to Ozempic that I think we've overlooked that might speak in a very different, like pull us in a totally opposite direction to what the way we've been discussing these things so far. And that is, and I can only go anecdotally, there's just conversations I've heard from people I know talking about people they know who are on Ozempic or whatever. One of the objections is that people who have gone down this path, especially when they don't need to for some health reason, it's an aesthetic thing, they're just boring people. So we can no longer go out for lunch.
I haven't seen any randomized control trial of boringness.
Yeah.
And it's ambiguous.
No, so this is, it's anecdotal, right?
Yeah.
But it's like, we can't socialize anymore.
We do. I mean, dieting in general is a disconnect from the people that we like to socialize with and the people that we like to break bread with and share our meal or at least food life with.
Or at least it can be, yes.
Yeah.
But I think what I want to tease out here is, I think the objection is, so you are prioritizing the attainment of some aesthetic goal over and above all these other things that matter in life and that make up a rich life.
I think the prioritization, like that value system, is not one that they're bringing without baggage into the health realm. So they may have had their GP or whoever has prescribed that GLP-1 to them tell them that their life depends on taking this. There's a lot of moralization that goes on in medical encounters as well that is far beyond just the scope of what the evidence shows and having a good conversation about, you know, an informed consent, supporting conversation.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah. And I'm not getting into the realm of the medical side.
But that means when people are on this path, they've taken it and it's a injection. So there's no take backs. It's not like you can decide, oh, I'm not going to take it today. You're kind of stuck on it for the period after you've had the injection, depending on the frequency of injections you've got. And so if they feel like their life is on the line, this now becomes an existential quest to be a smaller weight. And so we're no longer talking about marginal health gains from any kind of changes to weight or lifestyle. It's now, my life depends on this. This is the most important thing in my life. Rah, rah.
Different kind
of values system.
Sure, but I'm not talking, at least I don't think I'm talking about that sort of case. I'm talking about the case of people who, it's unashamedly aesthetic what they're after.
Okay.
And the objection they get from amongst their friendship group, and by the way, can I be really clear? This is not me describing anyone who's on Ozempic or Beat. Like, that's not, I'm talking about a very specific objection that arises in response to something like these weight loss drugs. And the objection is not that you haven't earned it, not that you are cheating your way to this healthy appearance, and that I misunderstand this healthy appearance. The objection actually is one of shallowness.
That's a superficial goal.
Right. And it reveals that you prioritize the superficial.
Yeah.
Right? It seems to me that that sort of objection is very much in line with the kind of concern that you have.
Yeah.
And it's very much different to the kind of concern or the kind of objections that Scott is talking about here. And yet, and again, I can only put this anecdotally. These are just conversations I've happened upon with people that I know, right? It's there. It's live. There's something about it that says, oh, well, there's some, you know, your value system seems out of whack if this is the most important thing in the world and it can displace all these other aspects of life that should be so, so essential.
I don't know. In my experience, there are these bubbles of little subcultural aspects that happen in friendship groups in that if they're in that friendship group and they're happy to openly talk about any aesthetic actions that they're taking, and it might be lip fillers, boobs, Ozempic, whatever. Mm. That tends to be, oh, this is a topic of conversation. In the literature, it's diet talk. And so we see that it does cluster that way. And yet in most of my personal circles, they're quite body positive groups. And so that conversation just wouldn't pass muster. And we all navigate around our different
Sorry, which conversation
people.
Do you mean?
Talking, admitting that they are on a particularly weight loss drug for nothing but aesthetic purposes that would be latched upon and then unpicked and do the discourse until we could really sort of see under the hood of it in those circles. And so I think it's still shame-filled in that it is something that will activate a caution button in people, in that they might talk about it with some people but not with others because of this sense of acceptability within clusters of their social groups. I don't think it's out in the open completely. And they certainly wouldn't talk to their GP about how they've managed to get the drug from the GP for the quote-unquote purpose of health, and yet it's really an aesthetic purpose. But these things also, they do exist. I think they feel like it's a happy accident that they'll happen to have more social currency with a smaller body weight, and how lucky is it that they also happen to qualify to get prescribed them. It's messy.
Yeah. There's something that you raised just in passing. The difference between intrinsic or inherent goal and an external goal.
Yeah.
which is very, very squarely the wheelhouse of a show like this. I don't disregard Waleed's point about sort of superficiality or people just not being so much social fun. Although, you know, I will say that there are all sorts of bad forms of consumption, of bad forms of eating, of bad forms of drinking, for instance, that are, say, socially facilitated or even socially mandated. And as someone who has removed himself from, I mean, I don't drink alcohol, I don't eat meat, I don't. So there are all sorts of forms of social enjoyment that are barred from me. And I realize I'm not a very fun person in a whole lot of sort of other social settings. But the bigger issue for me, I guess, is you raised the point before about a doctor laying it on a patient that their life depends on a certain amount of weight. There is, it seems to me, a social equivalent to that, almost a kind of social demand or social mandate. If there are all of these mechanisms that are available to you, all of them externally oriented, all of them having to do not with how you are or how healthy you are, but how you appear, it means that there is a kind of sanction or a form of censure that goes along with that. When, say, I mean, there are forms of eating that are objectively better than other forms of eating.
Oh, yes, good nutrition is good. That is good for one.
There are forms of self-discipline and exercise and self-restraint that are objectively better than certain forms of
yes.
license or indulgence or excess or whatever.
Yep.
But what is the good that attaches to these things? Are these things externally oriented? Or does this have to do with my state of well-being, which is connected to both what I consume, how I am in the world, my own levels of fitness and activity, and so on? And I guess my concern is that I believe that we're kind of minimizing just how heavy the external weight is. You must conform to this particular way of being if you want certain forms of social commerce to be open to you.
Yes, it's hugely influential in people's decision making. When, as dietitians who are weight inclusive dietitians, who are trying to undo decades of diet thinking, diet culture, and to try to help people understand how their own bodies work, what nutrition in the context of health and well-being versus nutrition in the context of body size control looks like, and being able to critique just how toxic these body standards are that lean towards whiteness, youngness, thinness, a certain feminine aesthetic ideal, all of those things, to be able to develop essentially armor to navigate the world, to be able to not, when you're hearing those ads that are clearly veiled advertising for weight loss drugs, talk to your doctor. I mean, they're skirting on the edge of legality.
Hmm.
So that those ads can be met with a critical attitude versus a, oh yeah, I guess I've tried everything else, I better go and talk to my doctor. We're trying to create empowerment and a sense of confidence to be able to navigate a world that is inherently hostile to somebody who lives in a larger body at the moment. Part of my hopeful change making is to make the health system one where, regardless of the body that you're in, you can access things that are very normal to access for a person, like knees, like IVF, like maternity care where you live, including if you live very remotely and on country. So all of these issues of healthcare equity and access, weight is one that there tends to be a lower appetite to tackle. But it is important if we've got 2/3 of the population who's locked out. So we're talking about how heavy, quote unquote, this issue is. It's hugely heavy. And it is a matter of life and death, but not because of that person's body, but because we have an insufficient health system there to support their health and well-being. So if you're a health professional and you're not comfortable working with larger bodies, or you're a bit concerned that you might not have the skill set, go and seek that out. There are people who are doing your profession on much larger bodies. Learn from them. We've got 2/3 of the population who are clamoring for great healthcare. Be the hero to them.
We are, I'm afraid, out of time, Fiona, but thank you so much. It's been a really stimulating conversation. So
thanks.
It's been really good to speak. Fiona Willer, President of Dietitians Australia, lecturer in nutrition and dietetics at the Queensland University of Technology, our guest for this week's edition of The Mindfield. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, you can listen to us anytime on the ABC Listen app, and you can catch us again next week on ABC Radio National.
And the Butterfly Foundation helpline once again is 1-800-333-4673. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.